I'm Michael Ignatieff, and I teach human rights and the laws of war at Harvard. And I'm here in Geneva, the headquarters of the most important humanitarian organization in the world, the International Committee of the Red Cross. The atmosphere in Geneva is quiet, calm, like a university campus. But the people walking to and fro in front of me are about to go off into some of the most dangerous places in the world, to Syria, to the Central African Republic, to the Congo, to places where law and order barely exist, and these young people are at the front line of the world's attempt to get people who are in conflict to respect the basic laws of war, meaning you don't fire on civilians, you don't fire on hospitals, you don't kill innocent women and children. The basic rules. The Red Cross is charged with enforcing these rules, and it's never been more difficult to enforce them.
The International Red Cross is 150 years old this year, but it faces critical new challenges. Terrorists and drug lords who couldn't care less about the laws of war, chemical weapons and new technologies like drones and cyber, and new threats that have turned Red Cross workers into targets and victims. In this program, I'll be following the International Red Cross's work in Colombia, then in Syria, and finally, its attempt to regulate America's war on terror. But to begin with, I've come to a training center in the woods outside Geneva to see how the Red Cross is training its latest recruits.
Marie-Servane Desjonquers has worked for the ICRC for 10 years, and she can still remember her training week.
It was a tough weeks for the training. It was the beginning of the war in Iraq, and the first week, one of our colleagues was killed. And then the week after, one of our colleagues was killed in Afghanistan.
And have you come under attack yourself when you've been on a mission?
Yes, it happened once in Sudan. Our house was attacked at night by armed men. And so we had to stay under the bed for several hours. And then the day after, we had to leave the town we were based in.
But do you have a sense of why you were attacked that night?
You know, when you live in a conflict zone, you know such thing can happen. But no, you never know why it comes to you. But it's also your job to be there, and you believe that the people will respect your mission.
It's respect for the mission and for the Red Cross and Red Crescent emblems that enables the Red Cross to get through the checkpoints manned by armed forces or gangs and reach the victims of war. Despite competition in a crowded humanitarian field, the International Red Cross upholds its reputation as one of the most professional humanitarian organizations in the world. Its mandate is written into the Geneva Conventions. The ICRC, as it's known, defends a utopia, the simple idea that war can be restrained by law, that warriors should fight with honor, not kill innocent civilians, shell hospitals, target ambulances, or doctors trying to help the wounded. Defending this utopia has never been easy. Recently, the Red Cross has found itself becoming a target.
Militants have attacked a guest house used as an office by the Red Cross in eastern Afghanistan.
A British aid worker has been found beheaded in the Pakistani city of Quetta. Khalil Dale was working for the International Red Cross.
One of the first victims of war and violence is the healthcare system itself.
Most shocking of all were attacks by government soldiers and insurgent groups alike on doctors and nurses, hospitals and clinics in conflict zones from Yemen to Somalia. If armed groups won't respect medical neutrality, the Red Cross can't protect victims. I don't think there's any way that you can be trained to anticipate those kind of situations, but I think it's pretty important to have as much training as you can. We're just approaching a checkpoint in which a Red Cross vehicle with the Red Cross emblem has been stopped by a group of soldiers who've asked to see their papers. The soldiers will want to get into the vehicle because they say we want to accompany our wounded soldier through the next checkpoint. That is against the rules. If you have armed men inside an ambulance, it makes you a legitimate target, so the delegates have to learn to negotiate so that the armed soldiers are out of the vehicle.
If you want to send a car to pick him up, or if you want to have somebody to stay here with him, that's fine, but he's not going over this line.
So we can take him back to the office. He's not staying here.
Sadia and James are two delegates who did the checkpoint exercises earlier in the day, and I want to talk to them about their experience. Sadia, what was the training like this morning? Aren't you thinking all the time I'm playing a game?
To be honest, you really forget that, because most of us who are here, this is not the first time we're in the field. And you tap into that feeling of complete helplessness. You know, you do feel scared. You do feel that there's pressure on you.
James, you've been through this training for the last week. What was the most unexpected or surprising aspect of it for you?
I would say that was today, to be honest. Just now at the checkpoint, I was scared. My heart was racing. We had things that we hadn't been prepared for. And I think that's very important as well, because you have to be versatile, you have to adapt, you have to expect the unexpected, if possible.
I first began to follow the ICRC in 1997 when I went with them to Afghanistan. And so I've come back here to see what's changed in the years since 1997, and clearly a lot has changed. One of the things that's changed is that the kinds of armed groups you're meeting now don't have a clear chain of command. They are often criminal. They're often related to drugs. That is, the kind of armed insurgent they're meeting now is very different than the ones that they were meeting in 1997.
When we look at the needs of populations and the way in which we address those needs, that has evolved a great deal.
Pierre Cranboul is the head of operations at the International Red Cross. I wanted to speak to him about how the ICRC is working in contemporary conflict situations.
I think the notion that people have about humanitarian work is often associated with short-term interventions, in and out, it's the emergency, the acute phase. But if you look at the largest operations that we have around the world today, in Afghanistan, in Congo, in Somalia, in Israel and the occupied territories, in Colombia and elsewhere, are all places that we've been in now for two, three or four decades. And of course that changes not only the way that we look at the implications for the populations that are affected and at risk, but also the way in which we work. We don't deal with the acute only, we also deal with a certain number of chronic consequences of armed conflict. So those are some of the issues that have changed.
150 years ago, the Red Cross was set up to provide emergency medical relief to soldiers on the battlefield. Now it's embedded in zones of chronic conflict like Afghanistan, and it's helping civilians caught in the crossfire between drug gangs in Latin America. There's no question the civilians caught in the middle of the drug wars need all the help they can get. But the issue is whether the Red Cross is the right organization to provide it. Take a country like Colombia. The ICRC's been there for over 40 years, right through the brutal civil war between the government and the Marxist rebels. But now that this civil war is dying down, another conflict is flaring up. The gang warfare for control of drug territory in poor urban neighborhoods. The Civil War was a recognized internal armed conflict under the terms of the Geneva Conventions. But what about the drug wars? Few of the gangs battling it out in the favelas of Medellin would officially qualify as parties to the conflict. So what exactly is the International Red Cross doing getting involved in protecting civilians there? Jeremy McDermott is the executive director of Insight Crime, an NGO dedicated to the study of organized crime throughout Latin America. They're based in Medellin.
On a national level, the government have now recognized that the principal threat to security, and particularly citizen security, is the BACRIM. It is this new generation of drug trafficking syndicates, of which Medellin is home now to two. And indeed, these groups are responsible for more homicides, more displacements, and more violence than the Marxist rebels who've been fighting for 50 years. These gangs, the combos, some of them have become extremely sophisticated. They control entire neighborhoods, and people are driven out of certain neighborhoods because they refuse to cooperate with the gangs.
Last year, the ICRC started working here in order to help victims of gang violence.
Medellin is located in a valley called Aburrá Valley.
Mike Londoño was born in Medellin and has started working for the ICRC. He took us on a tour of the city to see some of the work the Red Cross is doing to help the victims of violence.
So all the mountains that surround the city are the neighborhoods where we are working.
we're going to meet a woman called Fanny, who came to Medellin 8 years ago after being displaced from her village by the conflict. She moved into one of the neighborhoods where the Red Cross is working.
She arrived in a neighborhood called La Sierra. She had 3 young sons, and she was very scared of taking her sons out of the house. So they were with no study, no school. So what we did with this family was make a loan, and she started buying potatoes.
Fanny received help from the Red Cross to set up a small business selling potatoes. Her sons help her, and the little business is her way to keep her boys out of trouble.
Before, my sons studied at school. I had to pull them out of school 3 years ago when they were 16 because there were gangs operating within the school who were recruiting gang members. The bigger one opposed recruitment into this group, and that's when the gang started causing problems. Once the gang members approached him as we were in the lorry, the gang members recognized him and asked him to step out of the car, but I wouldn't let him get out. I said they had to kill me first. This is why I want to get out of this area as soon as I can. I want to give my son emotional stability so that we can succeed in life.
The International Red Cross now works in the schools of Medellin, trying to protect children who've been displaced by civil war and now find themselves threatened if they don't join the drug gangs. The ICRC supports local Red Cross volunteers who work in the classrooms to spread a message of peace that can lure children away from the glamorous and threatening image of the gangs. Diane Cavea is the International Red Cross worker in Medellin.
The kids, they are living in an environment which is affected by violence. That's the only thing they are exposed to. And this project is exposing them to other things. So they learn a lot about the Red Cross movement, about the humanitarian principles. They learn also how to live together, to accept each other, and to respect each other.
The children in this school are reciting the 7 humanitarian principles of the Red Cross movement, and you can tell they're engaged and motivated. But how can the Red Cross message possibly compete with the dark glamour of the drug lords and their cult of violence? Jeremy McDermott.
The culture of violence in these marginal neighborhoods of Medellin is a social problem, as well as a criminal justice issue. Young men in these neighborhoods and even minors are attracted to this life and provide a ready and constant stream of recruits to these gangs. And until this culture in the neighborhoods is changed, it's going to be very difficult, if not well nigh impossible, to dismantle the Medellin gangs and the Medellin mafia.
Violence in the favelas is a real problem, but it does not constitute a war. International humanitarian law doesn't apply in this context, and even promoting human rights is difficult when you're talking to criminal gangs. Jordi Reich is the head of the delegation in Colombia.
When we're talking about these criminal groups, unfortunately, we're talking often about very young people, not very well-read, that have hardly gone through any sort of schooling, and talking to them in high terms of laws will take you nowhere. And yes, it is a difficult task because changing the behavior of people is extremely difficult, no matter with which group. I mean, whether this is an army or it's a guerrilla or it's one of these new groups.
At the Geneva headquarters, I wanted Director General Yves Dacour to explain what they're trying to do in Colombia.
You've moved into this work with other armed groups, but what I'm not understanding is how you get any leverage over them.
You then have to challenge your own assumption, because your assumption is that criminal groups are not interested about controlling territory. What we discover is exactly the contrary. Even in favela, most of the criminal groups are fighting for a territory. And then, when there is a territorial issues, then suddenly we, ICRC, have a small, but we have a leverage.
If it's a struggle for the ICRC to get leverage over the drug gangs in Medellin, it's even more of a challenge for them in Syria.
The ICRC said the Syrian authorities had told them it was too dangerous to enter the area because of mines and booby traps. But negotiations.
The civil war, now entering its third year, has killed more than 100,000 people. The country is split in two, and atrocities have been committed on all sides. With reports that chemical weapons were used close to eastern Damascus, the struggle in Syria has taken on a horrifying new dimension. At the time of recording, a U.S. airstrike has been averted, but the humanitarian crisis continues to worsen.
This represents, no matter what the conclusions are, a serious escalation.
No outward sign of blood or lacerations, but people who could barely breathe.
166 ICRC staff members based in Damascus are supporting local Arab Red Crescent volunteers in a desperate battle to help victims of the war and restrain both sides. The ICRC has been blocked and kept from reaching victims by the Assad government and rebel groups alike. So how does the Red Cross persuade fighters to respect the laws of war when both sides break the rules and Islamist rebels regard the laws of war themselves as a piece of Western hypocrisy? Interviewed by the humanitarian news website IRIN, some Syrian opposition leaders express little respect for the laws of war. Abu Musab is a commander of the Al-Ansar Brigades, a jihadist group affiliated with the U.S.-designated terrorist organization Jabhat al-Nusra. His words are voiced by an actor.
We've lost faith in international laws and policies. This is why Islamist groups are gaining ground. At first, they were weak, but then people realized it doesn't help them if they adhere to Western standards. So the Islamist groups grow stronger. The international community expects us to comply with the international humanitarian law, but nobody cares if our rights are being violated. For example, if you catch a Syrian Air Force pilot who's responsible for killing hundreds of people, of course you'd kill him.
Of course you'd kill him. That's the logic that the Red Cross has to challenge. At Red Cross headquarters, I asked Pierre Cranboul how he convinces desperate men fighting for their lives to play by the rules.
Often you hear, since the other side isn't going to respect, why should I respect rules of international humanitarian law? And I've always found that a very surprising comment, because at the same time, whoever the group is that says that never wants to be compared to the other side, except when it is about non-respect of the law. And so I always say to them, well, actually, you've now told me for the last half hour that you're different from the other side. So why don't you take the lead and actually show greater respect, which would be a strong differentiating factor from what you say the opposing side is doing, which is an interesting thing that I think we need to continuously put forward, as opposed to lowering the benchmark, trying to push it higher. But it's a huge effort in every context, and we're far from being successful in that on a daily basis.
The president of the International Red Cross, Peter Maurer, visited President Bashar Assad of Syria last September. It was his first official visit to Damascus, and it was grim. Assad wouldn't give them access to his prisons, and the rebels' chain of command was splintering. Neither side was obeying the rules.
Both sides would prevent ICRC or the Syrian Arab Red Crescent to go into areas where wounded soldiers from the other side are in order to help them, because they do not accept some of the fundamentals of the Geneva Conventions, because they want to win the war and put them out of service.
But isn't it a cop-out to blame both sides for the Syrian humanitarian catastrophe? Human Rights Watch has recorded government airstrikes deliberately targeting civilian bread queues and hospitals. Surely the Syrian government must be held more responsible for this situation than the rebel groups. Not according to the International Red Cross. Both sides have obligations under the terms of the Geneva Conventions, and the ICRC refuses to compromise its neutrality and impartiality by commenting publicly on either side's violations. Right through its history, the ICRC has had to negotiate the fine line between confidentiality and complicity. One of the most testing cases in recent years involved America and the so-called war on terror.
Guantanamo Bay. Over 600 men are being held here by the USA as part of its war against terror.
The president is well within his power under our constitution as well as international law to do what we are doing.
The US authorities have put the detainees in Guantanamo beyond the law. We certainly mean that Guantanamo is a legal black hole.
The government of the United States is the International Red Cross's biggest funder and also one of its biggest problems. The Red Cross was originally given access to the American detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba in 2002 and to Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq in 2003. Red Cross workers who visited Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo both sent highly critical confidential reports to the U.S. authorities, detailing evidence of torture and abuse. The Red Cross kept these reports confidential, but U.S. government insiders ultimately leaked them. When they went public, the Red Cross had to distance itself from the leaks, worried that it would lose access to U.S. detention sites around the world. This is the key moral trade-off in Red Cross work: keeping abuses secret in the hope that silent pressure will make governments clean them up. But it's a trade-off that comes with a cost. What happens when governments do nothing? What happens when they use Red Cross visits to their prisons as alibis to buff up their public image? I asked Director General Yves Dacour how he keeps the Red Cross from falling into these traps.
We're very careful about that risk. And when we feel that what we can bring is counterproductive for reputation or for prisoner, then we say stop. It happened recently. Uzbekistan is an example. Myanmar at the time was also an example where we really felt that we worked hard, we tried again, and there was just no improvement. And you had a government which clearly says ICRC is visiting, so don't touch. Then there is a moral responsibility where ICRC has a moment to say, okay, we stop it.
One of the most difficult issues that you faced after 9/11 was the emergence of what are called black sites, that is, CIA detention sites that were outside the American judicial system, outside the system of international law. Are you satisfied now that the ICRC has access to every single prisoner detained by the United States of America?
If I look over the last few years, I have the impression that yes, we do have access to any single prisoner detained by the American, yes.
On the question of torture, there are well-founded proofs that America engaged in abusive interrogations both in Abu Ghraib and other places during the last decade. Are you satisfied now as the ICRC that they've got torture out of their detention system?
What seems even more important for me is they've got torture outside of their policy, which seems absolutely critical.
But even when torture is out of the policy, it may still be there in the practice.
Sometimes is, but I would say there has been a very clear improvement in the way policies have been applied, let's say, in the U.S. detention facilities, absolutely, over the last 10 years.
The Americans have pioneered the development of lethal drones in their war against al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Yemen. Where America leads, other governments will surely follow. If drones are controlled by a man on the ground, then the International Red Cross believes that the traditional rules governing conduct of hostilities still apply. But what about when it comes to automated drones, computerized killing machines? That's the next frontier that military technology is already crossing. I wonder what Newt Dorman, head of the ICRC's legal division, makes of that future.
There we have first the question, what is really realistic? Is it at all feasible that you could create a program that could apply the rules on the conduct of hostilities? But then the other question that certainly arises and where more debate is required, is it acceptable that machines are taking decisions on life and death? And this is certainly a debate that needs to take place and probably as early as possible, because we know as well that once a particular technological development is underway, it's always very difficult to stop something from happening.
This afternoon, I am opening a hearing on cybersecurity. We are going to examine
attacks on our wired world could take many forms: nation against nation, cyber terrorism,
or organized crime.
The Red Cross believes the laws of war should apply to cyberspace, just like any battlefield of the past. But adapting the law means we'll all have to think differently. The internet that we're used to think of as a global commons, free for everyone to use, has already become a battlefield.
In a way, the internet and many networks are both civilian and military. So does this then mean that any of these networks become lawful military targets? How do you deal with a situation that computers are in other countries, non-belligerent countries? Does it mean that you can take action against these computers? You have as well the obligation to take everything feasible to separate civilian infrastructures from military infrastructures to protect the civilian population. But if most of what is in the cyber realm is dual use, what is then the consequence of this rule? So I think there are lots of questions that need to be asked. And after a careful assessment, then I guess the international community needs to move. And it is our role certainly to remind the international community to do so.
The ICRC is responsible for updating the laws of war to reflect the contemporary world. Changing the rules too hastily can be dangerous, but failing to adapt can leave the laws of war moribund. We should all hope the Red Cross gets the balance right. Making war less brutal was always a utopian project, but we need utopias. Utopias point us in the right direction, towards a world where there is less of the violence that shames us all.